from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. Always feel bad disappointing our dear listeners, but Dave Graham is out today. I'm Colin Mine, the managing editor of VT Digger, filling in for Dave. You'll have some other fantastic guest hosts through the rest of the week. We have a wonderful show lined up for you today. To kick things off is Xander Landon, VT Digger's politics editor, to catch us up on what's going on with Vermont's independent junior senator, Bernie Sanders, out there on the presidential campaign trail. Obviously, Super Tuesday a couple days ago, so looking forward to what's next. Sanders had a press conference at his Burlington headquarters yesterday. Find out what he said there and what it means for the rest of the race. After that, at 9:30, Josh Ronski, the executive director of the Vermont Progressive Party, is going to join us via telephone. He's going to talk about a romp the Progressive Party had over in Burlington on Super Tuesday. They now control the city council. They won two seats last year. They flipped two seats this year. They now have a 7-5 majority over all other parties on the Burlington City Council. We're going to talk to him about what that means, what the Progressive Party's plans are coming out of that election on Tuesday. He said next up is the mayor's office for the Progressive Party. So Mayor Moreau Weinberger has been put on notice. So we're going to talk to him about what that means, who that candidate might be, and what their plans are over there for the Queen City. And then for the second hour, we're going to talk to researchers at UVM about Vermont's hemp industry, which has been booming in a lot of ways. The last hemp season, as we reported at VT Digger, loads and loads of people were growing hemp for the first time. Somewhat disappointing for some sort of realization of the realities in the industry, I suppose. There was sort of some capacity for processing, but a lot of people really hopeful about what the hemp industry can do for Vermont farmers and for Vermont's rural economy. So we're going to talk to folks over UVM about everything you could possibly want to know about hemp. But as I said, to start things off here is Xander Landon, VT Digger's politics editor. What's going on, Xander?
Hey, did you introduce me as an editor?
I think I did, but there's been no promotion. That's merely a...
I'll take the pay bump if that's what you're offering here.
Oh, that decision is above my pay grade even. VT Digger's politics editor, reporter, Xander Landon, on the air. We're here with us. What's going on?
Thanks so much for having me, Colin.
Yeah. So you were in Massachusetts on Super Tuesday, and that race didn't quite go as planned. Why don't we start there?
Yeah, so I went down to Massachusetts this week to cover the Super Tuesday race, and what we were all sort of expecting, what pundits were expecting, what reporters were expecting, what voters were expecting, who I was talking to on the ground, was this to be, in Massachusetts, a very close race between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. The polling leading up to last week had shown that the two were neck and neck. Sanders had a bit of an edge, even. It looked like he was probably going to sweep the state. Then as the results were coming in Tuesday evening, it became clear that Joe Biden had a pretty substantial lead, and he did end up winning the Massachusetts primary, as he did most of the Super Tuesday states. And it was just sort of brought to bear really sort of underscored the strength of his campaign and the momentum that he was able to take hold of that was really unexpected on Super Tuesday, and really sets back Sanders, who was pretty much viewed as the front runner, and had many had already been saying would become the Democratic nominee, and you know, now I think that's sort of been turned on its head. And Biden, after the South Carolina win, after the moderate field has consolidated and people have dropped out, he is really well positioned.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth noting that a couple weeks ago, we sort of felt like Biden or Sanders, rather, was the sort of presumptive candidate. Now it feels very much the other way, but there's still a lot of states left. So who knows what's to come. On Tuesday night, you were with the Sanders crowd at a watch party there. What was the feeling there when it started to, the realization started to dawn on folks that it wasn't going to be a good night for Sanders in Massachusetts?
I was surprised at the level of optimism. I mean, people were definitely not expecting Sanders to lose in Massachusetts, largely because there's a pretty large organizing effort on the ground in the Boston area and other parts of the state. I talked to people that were organizing in the suburbs west of Boston. I talked to people that were organizing in the city. And, you know, Biden really wasn't on the ground at all in Massachusetts. It was really a Warren Sanders sort of turf war. And I, at the same time, you know, that it was a surprise, a lot of the people were saying that they think that the energy that the campaign has been able to sort of drum up will push forward into the other states that still have to vote. It's still, you know, relatively early in the delegate. In terms of the delegates, they're not that far apart. You know, I think Biden is ahead by 60 is the last time I checked. The problem is the momentum that Biden has going into these other states, and also the fact that Sanders really hasn't, you know, most of the strongest contingent, you know, of his base is young voters, people under 30. In some cases, people under 45. And especially with the under 30 folks, he's not turning more of them out. He's not getting the turnout that he needs to beat Biden, who is going to reliably get people, you know, 50 and over voting for him more than, I mean, now we only have three candidates, so more than Sanders is. I mean, Sanders is not very popular with older voters, Democrats. And so that's the problem. I mean, going into these other states, is he going to be able to, and are these people that say, you know, Sanders, you know, is able to generate all this energy, are they going to really be able to turn that, you know, capitalize that on that? And right at this point, the campaign hasn't been able to really do that.
Yeah. It seems like the prevailing hot take at the moment is that this is looking an awful lot like 2016, where Sanders is doing really, really well among certain demographics, especially young folks. He seems to have also really caught on among the Latino vote, but that older, you know, the sort of same people that Hillary Clinton won, looks like Biden is well positioned to take again, and therefore it gives Sanders a tough path to victory. We're talking here to Xander Landon, VT Digger's politics reporter. We want you to join the conversation. Call in local 1-802-244-1777 or toll free 1-877-291-8255. You're listening to Dave Graham Show. Xander, Senator Sanders yesterday had a press conference at his Burlington headquarters. The campaign put out a press release early in the day, said at 2 o'clock he's going to make an announcement about the future of his campaign. What did he have to say?
Well, he basically said that, you know, the results in Super Tuesday of the Super Tuesday states is not going to, he's showing no sign of stopping. He says that him and Biden are neck and neck in this race, which may be a bit of an exaggeration, but it, you know, certainly showing that he's going to press forward. The campaign is going to press forward. He also addressed Elizabeth Warren, and there has been a lot of speculation and, you know, talk about what's Elizabeth Warren going to do now that she, you know, had a pretty poor showing on Super Tuesday. Didn't come in even second place in all, you know, any of the states that voted. There, you know, going back to, you know, Massachusetts on Tuesday night, there were a lot of Sanders people that were blaming Elizabeth Warren for Bernie's poor performance in Massachusetts and elsewhere. I mean, you know, there's the assumption that a lot of Elizabeth Warren voters are going to vote for Sanders if she drops out, which I think is largely true. I think it's a little more nuanced than that, but I think that a lot of them would vote for Bernie. And there was a lot of blaming going on in the crowd, you know, that I was in. And so, you know, Sanders was sort of addressing the fact that he, you know, I think he spoken with Warren earlier that day, that she's sort of rethinking how to move forward with her campaign. And, you know, no pressure. He's not saying, I think Elizabeth Warren should drop out, but definitely addressing that aspect. I'm not sure if he was questioned and then brought that up or if he brought it up naturally, but it came up. Another thing that happened yesterday was Bloomberg dropped out, you know, which is a huge development in the race after pouring millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars to sort of, you know, plaster the country with advertisements and whatnot. He won American Samoa, I think, was the one place.
Big win.
Well, the one place where he was able to come away with a victory, and everywhere else, you know, not doing so well. So he drops out, but that's more ammunition for Biden. But, you know, Sanders, you know, was showing resolve and showing that, you know, things haven't changed for him and he wants to focus on the issues. And he did go after Joe Biden on his voting record. Said that we're really two different candidates here.
Yeah, I've seen both Bernie and his surrogates really, you know, going hard at this Iraq war, at, you know, Biden's vote for the Iraq war, Biden's vote for NAFTA, you know, sort of really trying to bring out the lowlights, I suppose, of his voting record.
Yeah, I mean, that is something that he's been doing since the beginning of the campaign. But now, I think, you know, when you had a big field, it was a little more diluted, and I think his attacks were more, it was more general at the entire field of moderates, and it was sort of him and Warren versus everyone else. And now it's, the field is winnowed, and I would expect the next debate, whenever that is, to be pretty intense, and they, you know, very different candidates.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting indeed to see if Elizabeth Warren is a part of that debate. I want to talk about the results in Vermont specifically, but before we do that, we got a caller on the line, Paul from Moncton. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Hey, I appreciate the conversation regarding the election, but I want to take it a little bit deeper. And what I'm about ready to talk about actually has some repercussions in the Republican Party, and I'll explain in a minute. Bernie's now closing in on 80 years old. Regardless of what happens with this presidential election, the focal point of the Progressive Party has been Bernie. Have we had any discussions or any talks about what happens after Bernie? And the reason I say it, there's repercussions or issues with the Republican Party, the same thing could be said with the Tea Party movement and the right wing of the Republican Party, with Rush Limbaugh in his later years and having advanced lung cancer. And I'm just wondering who, you know, steps up to fill the roles of either issue. But in this case, let's talk about Bernie. I mean, is it AOC or Tlaib? Are they ready for that prime time nationally? Both have a few issues that they'd have to deal with. But, yeah, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it there with AOC. I mean, I think Bernie has already, you know, sort of trying to highlight the support of the squad, as they're called, you know, AOC and Tlaib and others. Pramila Jayapal, who's the U.S. rep from Washington, has been a sort of, you know, leader in the Progressive Party and has come out strong for Bernie and seems to be on the same page with him about every issue. So, you know, I think it seems like Bernie has sort of set up here for the next phase of the progressive wing of the party to really be led by women of color. I would say on the other side, you talked about Rush Limbaugh and the sort of Tea Party movement, you know, that you sort of have a lot of older white men as well who lead that wing. And, you know, it seems like younger white men are set to sort of move into those leadership positions on the right side of the political spectrum. Thanks for the call, Paul. So I wanted to sort of hone in here on the results in Vermont in particular. Bernie Sanders won in a landslide on Super Tuesday, also town meeting day here in Vermont. But the results weren't quite what they looked like in 2016. What did we see as far as his margin of victory here this time around, Xander?
I think he got about 50% of the Democratic votes. You know, that compare that to how he did in the 2018 Senate race when he was up for re-election. That was about 70% of the vote. So you can't compare them, you know, directly, but 70% of voters in the state, people who vote in the state, supported Sanders last time, but in this primary, you clearly lost some of that support to other candidates. But the only other candidate who did well enough to earn any delegates is Joe Biden. He got 22%. I did, you know, when I was at this Massachusetts event, you know, the results were coming in from all over the place. And, you know, on the screen, CNN. And I did, you know, one person I was speaking with noted that she was surprised that he didn't do better in Vermont. She was expecting, you know, an even stronger victory. I mean, 50% in a Democratic primary is pretty good when the field is, you know, more than two people. And last time it was a very different race with Clinton. It was just Clinton and Sanders. And you know, you have to think, you know, maybe the Sanders camp is a little disappointed they didn't do better here. And that in particular, they didn't sweep all the delegates, that they lost some to Joe Biden. But that's reflective of the overall performance, you know, on Super Tuesday, where Biden did better than really anyone had expected him to.
Yeah, I remember in those first three primaries, a lot of people were, you know, you saw the sort of pundits and polling analysts, you know, looking at the sort of combined moderate votes and saying that if you had taken Buttigieg and Klobuchar and Biden and put them together, that they would have dominated Sanders. And a lot of the sort of Sanders supporters and surrogates were saying that's not how elections work, that you can't just say, like, you know, if you put these people together, you win this just because they happen to be moderates. Turns out you kind of can, that when Buttigieg and Klobuchar were pulled out of the race, that you really had, like, everything went to Biden, and therefore Biden suddenly became, you know, this sort of incredibly strong candidate. And here in Vermont, that was particularly the case. I think the last poll we saw before the election was in late February, and number two behind Sanders was Buttigieg at about 13. So he was sort of flirting with that delegate line of 15%. Buttigieg pulls out, Klobuchar pulls out, and then Biden comes with about 20% of the votes in Vermont and walks away with some delegates. So really interesting dynamic there.
It's really interesting how Buttigieg kind of had a fall from grace. And I mean, he won Iowa, he almost won New Hampshire, and then kind of just dropped off, you know, without much, you know, I don't know if it was just the states that were voting, those bases of voters, but, you know, he was eclipsed in Nevada when Bernie Sanders had his strong win. But didn't do well at all, you know, didn't do well at all in South Carolina. It's interesting how, you know, the race so far has been a lot, you know, just based on sort of spurts of momentum, you know, sort of just bring it one way or another really quickly. And the Joe Biden South Carolina win was, you know, the biggest example of that. That really propelled him forward. I think that goes to show that the race isn't over yet. Something could happen that sort of changes the winds and you know, puts them you know, at Sanders' back. You know, if Warren dropped out and endorsed him, you know, the day before the March 10th primary, that would be you know, that would have to help him in this race. If you know, if somehow he was able to pull it off and win Michigan like he did in 2016, although I think that there's a lot of reasons why that's going to be a lot harder this time around. But if he did, you know, maybe, you know, one, three or four of the states on the table next week, that could change the game. I think that voters are really, you know, often making decisions based off of, you know, whatever the last vote was in whatever state before. You know, I think that the endorsements that Biden got were key to his success. And the consolidation of that moderate field. You know, even if it was just Buttigieg in the race or just Klobuchar, Sanders might have, you know, had a much stronger night. He might have still been the front runner at this point.
You're listening to the Dave Graham Show. I'm Colin Mine, guest hosting for Dave. I'm the managing editor of VT Digger. I'm here with Xander Landon, VT Digger's politics reporter. We've been talking about the 2020 race for president and what's going on with Senator Bernie Sanders after a rather disappointing performance on Super Tuesday. He's still alive, although the road ahead has gotten a whole lot tougher for him in a really short amount of time with former Vice President Joe Biden surging. We've got about 5 minutes left with Xander here, and I want to shift briefly to the State House here in Vermont, which is taking a one-week break, as they always do for town meeting day week. The most recent thing that you were writing about, Xander, was the vote on a marijuana market, a tax and regulated system for cannabis, called various different things, depending on who you ask. But how are things going with that?
Well, they're going well if you support a legalized marketplace for marijuana sales, because for the first time ever, the House passed this legislation, which was passed by the Senate and has been passed by the Senate, you know, various times. It had been stalled in the House for about a year. So the fact that, you know, committees that had been working on this were able to sort of get it together and get it over the finish line in the House is a big step for this legislation. It's probably the hardest step, other than what the governor's going to do. That's still up in the air. But they passed the bill last week. Now it's back, it goes back to conference committee, where the Senate and the House are going to have to come to sort of terms on some of the disagreements that they have on this policy before they send it to Phil Scott. Excuse me. And the biggest sticking point right now, as it really always has been with this legislation in some ways, is roadside saliva testing and how – and, you know, the sort of the conditions around how police are going to be able to use this roadside test, or in some cases it isn't even a roadside test. It's a test that takes saliva from drivers and it can essentially determine whether or not there are drugs in that person's system. You know, how that test can be used, and – really, the biggest issue is whether there should be warrants involved when you're given these tests. And lawmakers think that there should be warrants. The governor does not. And this is the biggest real sticking point that I think could, you know, make the difference between whether the state sees a legal market or not for cannabis.
And a lot of Democrats think that the roadside saliva testing are, you know, basically shouldn't happen at all, because yeah. You know, you're driving, you get pulled over, maybe a cop smells weed, they do a test, the test says indeed you've got some THC in your system, but that test doesn't actually, my understanding is that test doesn't actually say whether or not you're currently intoxicated. It's more of whether or not that drug exists at all.
That's right. I mean, marijuana can stay in your system for weeks, and so the test would be positive if you had, you know, if it was detectable from a time you had smoked or consumed cannabis 2 weeks ago.
So why is it so important for the governor to have it?
Well, the governor has said that he wants to see certain public safety provisions in place if we legalize a market for cannabis and dispensaries come into the state and start opening up. And, police have said that this is going to, you know, marijuana use is going to go up and we're going to have increased incidents with drivers on the road. We need better tools. And they point to the saliva test as something that they want to see. And the governor has always been concerned, particularly with public safety. He's a very sort of law and order governor. And he wants to sort of make sure that the police have these resources at their disposal if they think that they're necessary for this marketplace. Now, the Senate, as you suggest, is very opposed to this, has civil liberties concerns about the test itself. The House has generally supported saliva testing. They actually passed a saliva testing bill 2 years ago, then it died in the Senate. And I think that the Senate has signaled that they can live with the testing, but they want to see warrants. The governor says, I don't want to have, you know, any, I don't want to have to, there to be any barrier for police to be able to use this test. And there are other issues with the marijuana legislation as well. It's not a perfect, you know, sort of thing that everyone can agree on, but I think that that's sort of the the biggest issue. He says, the governor says, if there is a warrant requirement for saliva testing in this legislation, I can't support it.
And that is particularly significant because the House got, what, about 90 votes on this current version of the bill, yep. which is not enough for an override. We have about 2 minutes left, but one thing that I thought was interesting is that there was some sense that maybe Republicans were going to come out broadly in support of this, not unanimously, but I think that you had talked about maybe 20 of the 40 plus Republicans in the House we had heard might come out in it. I think significantly less than that ended up voting for it.
Only six.
And why didn't we see end up seeing the Republican support that we thought we might have in about a minute?
Well, I think part of it was a saliva testing issue. And I think that part of it was also, I spoke with a Republican, Scott Beck of St. Johnsbury last week, who voted for the legislation. A lot of Republicans back in 2018 when we legalized possession said that, opposed that, but said, you know, now that we're legalizing this, we should tax and regulate this as well. We should make money from this and we should make sure that the substance is available in a regulated, safe way. And Don Turner, then House Minority Leader, proposed an amendment saying now that we've legalized, we should regulate it. And a lot of the Republicans supported that. So he and others suspected that there were going to be a lot of Republicans that, you know, like they did in 2018, now want to say, let's tax and regulate this since it's legal and get some money and make sure it's safely obtainable. But didn't happen. And maybe part of that's because there's not as much money in this as people had previously expected. The tax revenue, a little bit lower.
Watch Xander's reporting on BT Digger for more on the push to legalize a marijuana market in Vermont. Thanks so much, Xander, for joining. Up next is Josh Ronsky, the executive director of Vermont's Progressive Party. Stick around.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue cute to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Good morning, Vermont. I'm Colin Mine, managing editor of VT Digger, filling in for Dave Graham here on the aptly named Dave Graham Show. For the next 30 minutes, we're going to talk about a pretty stunning turn of events in Burlington politics, where the Progressive Party has taken control of city council there. I think just about 7 years ago, in 2012, they were down to two members of the city council seat, and it really surged. They flipped two seats a year ago. They flipped two more seats this time around, and now have a 7-5 majority on the city council. Joining us to discuss these events is Josh Ronsky, the executive director of the Vermont Progressive Party. Good morning, Josh.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm excited to be on.
So I want to talk about the recent events on town meeting day here. But first, I was wondering maybe you could just introduce yourself and explain sort of how you came to be the executive director of the party here in Vermont.
Yeah, so I've been in this position for about 4 years. I came to Vermont originally from upstate New York, just outside of Albany. I came here in 2007 to go to school at St. Mike's. After I graduated, I did some work with a couple different labor unions. I was all over the country for a little while organizing unions. And then about 4 years ago, this position popped up, and I was always interested and excited about the Progressive Party. I always considered myself a progressive, like a capital P progressive, living in Burlington. And I applied and got hired, and it's been, you know, just a wonderful thing ever since.
So last year, Jack Hansen and Perry Freeman became the newest progressive city council members. And then just on Tuesday, Jane Stromberg and Zariah Hightower scored a couple, I don't know if they're upsets, but certainly they knocked off the incumbents. Jane Stromberg beat Adam Roof in Ward 8, and Zariah Hightower beat Sharon Busher in Ward 1. Sharon Busher in particular had been, I think for 32 years, had held that city council seat. So that's quite a victory. Explain to us why you think the Progressive Party has been performing so well at the ballot box there in Burlington the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, first of all, I think it is definitely big upsets. Anytime you unseat an incumbent, I think it's unexpected and a huge win. And it doesn't really happen. I don't know if there were any other incumbents that were unseated in Vermont on Tuesday, so that was very exciting. So the way we won, the couple of reasons we won, I think, first you have to look at, there's just broad dissatisfaction with the current mayor, the current administration, and the direction that he's taking our city for the past couple of years. We have a big hole in the middle of our downtown from a stalled development project. We have a huge issues in our police department. We have a situation where they sold off Burlington Telecom to a private developer when there was an option to keep it as a kind of somewhat public cooperative. There are just a number of decisions that I think people are very unhappy with that the mayor has made and the former Democratic majority, and a general sense that the city's not doing what needs to be done for working people. And we're more aligned with kind of developers and big businesses, not really taking the needs of working people seriously. So I think there's been this like general sense of dissatisfaction. And then what we were able to do is go out and we talk to every single voter in these wards, sometimes two times. We knocked every single door, sometimes two or three times. And Jane's race, she knocked every door eight times. And I'm not even joking. Like, they knocked through every single door eight times. And we did that because we had this mass base of people who were really excited to support our candidates. We had dozens and dozens of volunteers, many of whom had never been involved in the political process before, who got out there, went door knocking, made phone calls, and really spent the last couple of months working on these campaigns every single day. And even in Ward 5, the South End, the one seat we lost, I have huge, huge respect for Nate Lantieri, who won 46% against an incumbent. And that's a ward that is really kind of the heart of the Democratic base in the South End. And I think they never expected that we could do that well. I personally did not expect we were going to do that well. So the fact that this, you know, he's a 22-year-old guy, was able to get 46% of the vote against an 8-year incumbent in the heart of the kind of Democratic part of the city is just an incredible result. And again, that happened because they went out and they knocked every door. They talked to every resident. They brought people in who, you know, were first-time voters and they were excited to vote for us. And I would also say, like, the other piece of it is turnout was massive. This was like one of the highest turnout town meeting day elections in Burlington history. And I think that played a huge role in the results as well, because people who were feeling marginalized, who don't normally vote, came out and voted in this election, and they voted for us. And that's a huge thing. Yeah.
You're listening to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. If you want to join the conversation with Josh Ronsky, the executive director of Vermont's Progressive Party, you can call in. Local number is 244-1777, toll free 1-877-291-8255. Josh, you were just talking about sort of the both the organizing and the level of excitement that the progressives were able to bring to the sort of organizing efforts before today's this week's town meeting vote, when two more progressives flip seats in the city council, and you guys now have a 7-5 majority. And also the voter turnout. But I'm wondering, what is unique about Burlington, sort of? I mean, I know that you guys have a number of folks in the state house, I think 7 in the house, and a few Democrat progressives in the Senate. But it seems like, obviously, Burlington has long been the sort of heart of the progressive movement in Vermont. But how have you guys gone about sort of in these past 4 years since you've been the executive director, building excitement again around the party?
Yeah, no, Burlington is certainly the heart. We do have people all over the state, and we're very excited that David Zuckerman, who's a longtime progressive, is now running for governor. I think that's, you know, that shows, it's a huge thing for our party, and it shows how far we've come, even in the past couple of years. But yeah, I think about 10 years ago, when we lost the mayor's seat, there was a real sense that maybe the Progressive Party wasn't going to be around for another 10 years. And maybe, you know, we were down to just two seats. And I just, you know, it was a commitment. There were a couple individuals who really stayed around through those dark times and really kind of carried the torch forward. And continued to like to engage with party members and build. And over the last, you know, 4, 5, 6 years, we've really rebuilt, at least in Burlington, the party from the ground up. And we've brought in dozens of like new young people, people who are recent grads or college students, people who just moved here from other parts of the country or state. And, you know, it's an exciting place because people are familiar with, you know, this, we're a pretty non-traditional party, right? So most people aren't in other parts of the state or the country. They don't have any sense of like, you can actually elect, a non-democratic or non-Republican party candidate. But in Burlington, I think there is a strong sense and people are proud that you can actually do that here. And when we were able to show people that, you know, we actually had an alternative voice, that was reasonable and also could win, they were just so excited to like get on board with us and go out and help us win and run with us as well.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, in the past couple of years in particular, that, you know, on the national political stage, you have a former Burlington mayor and Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. Who's sort of been a champion of the progressive movement for mm-hmm. decades. And then a huge amount of sort of negative political feelings on the national level towards the current president, Donald Trump. Obviously, he's less popular in Vermont than anywhere else in the country. And I guess I'm wondering, how much do you draw the sort of success of getting young folks out and engaged, you know, in Burlington on a pretty local level, in these local races, you now have progressives controlling city council. How much do you draw a connection between that and the various forces at play in national politics?
Yeah, I think that's huge. And, before I answer that, I do think it's really amazing. Like, if you think about this for a second, Burlington progressives just won, took control of city council. I think in a year, we're going to win back the mayor's seat and have a progressive mayor. The person who started the Burlington progressive movement is Bernie Sanders when he won mayor of Burlington in 1981. He could be president of the United States. A 14-year progressive from Burlington, David Zuckerman, is now running for governor. He has a very good shot of winning. He could be the governor. So we could control, if you think about it, the progressive party that started in Burlington, people who came out of that movement could control every level of government from federal, state, local, on down in that city. So that's just like, I can't even believe that, thinking about that. It's just a really exciting thought. but to answer your question, I think it played a huge part. I think Bernie Sanders is tapping into something that has needed to be tapped into for a long time. And that's just like really anger and angst over the lack of care over economic inequality issues and issues of climate change and healthcare reform. And he's showing people that a new world is possible, that we can actually have these conversations around a more, much more progressive, almost more radical ideas. And it actually has a broad mass appeal. And what you saw in Burlington is, going into the election, I had no idea what was going to happen. I knew we had worked really hard, but I was worried that people were going to go and take a Democratic Party ballot, and then they were going to take a local town meeting day ballot, and they were going to be like, oh, well, I'm just going to vote for the Democrat because I voted in the Democratic primary. I was like really nervous that was going to be a thing. And I think what Bernie has done is shown people that no, like there are alternatives to kind of the Democratic establishment status quo that can actually win. And people know he was an independent in the Senate and Congress for many, many years. And I think they were excited to vote for us and excited to vote for something different.
Yeah, you've talked to people. Oh, sorry.
I was going to say, I think people are also angry at the Democratic establishment right now, both in Burlington and nationally, for the way they've kind of tried to push down these new ideas in this movement.
You've mentioned a couple times that sort of next up for the progressives is the mayor's office. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of these gains have happened under the administration of Mayor Moreau Weinberger, who's sort of firmly in the moderate camp as far as the Democrats go. He responded to the latest victories for the Progressives Party on Tuesday night, saying that he did not sort of agree that this was a referendum on his administration, and in fact pointed to the fact that voters supported a number of the ballot initiatives that his administration had been involved in putting before voters. That included a public safety tax increase that's going to mm-hmm. fund the operation of a new ambulance and the new North End, an increase in the city's housing trust fund, and a change that will make local ballots available 45 days before the elections. What are your thoughts on that, the sort of idea that the administration was sort of involved in putting forward a number of initiatives that were broadly supported by the same people who voted in two new progressive city councilors?
Well, so first I would say these are non-controversial ballot initiatives. These were initiatives that were also supported by all the progressive councilors and all of our candidates. So I would say the idea that somehow this is like a win for the mayor and not for us is kind of ludicrous. These are very, it's supporting the school budget. It's more money for the ambulance. It's a minor change to election law. I mean, these are not big sweeping things. If you want to look at one of the more controversial things that mayor has pushed, go last year to the downtown improvement district, which was a big priority of the mayor to privatize the Church Street Marketplace downtown. And that was rejected by the majority in Burlington. So I think, and that was a major priority of the mayor and Democratic city councilors. So yeah, I think all the ballot initiatives did pass, but these weren't, big controversial issues. These were just pretty generic, nuts and bolts kind of city government things that everyone supported.
Josh, I wanted to ask, we've been talking about sort of what's going on with Mayor Marone Weinberger and how sort of disaffection with his administration perhaps is driving some of the support for the Progressive Party. A lot of the folks who have been elected from the Progressive Party have been notably young. I don't think that there's anyone older than 30 the past couple of years, these four new members of city council that have now given the party control. And I believe some of them are barely over 20. And I guess I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on sort of the lack of experience of these folks who are now largely in control of Burlington City Council and therefore the city.
Yeah, well, and one note is that 2 years ago we did elect Brian Pine, who I believe is in his 50s, to Ward 3. So it's not like we're only electing people in their 20s and 30s. And we are running candidates, across the spectrum. But my response to that is that we should never underestimate young people. You look at someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She got elected, I believe, when she was 29 to Congress, to a district in Queens. And she's now one of the leaders in the progressive movement. And I don't think anyone would say that she is doing a poor job or unqualified. Some people might disagree with what she's doing.
I think some people, including some listeners in the show, might have that view. But yeah, certainly yeah. Her allies.
There are certainly disagreements.
Way.
Yeah, exactly. I think people are very excited about that. So I think if you can have a 29-year-old running for Congress and winning and doing well by many, many standards, I don't think it's a stretch to say that a 22-year-old or a 29-year-old just turned 30-year-old can be a city councilor in a city of 40,000 people. I think that, and you look at our candidates, just because you're young doesn't mean you're inexperienced. Even our 22-year-old winner, Jane Stromberg, was on the board of VPIRG. She represents a largely a student ward. It's a ward that was created a couple of years ago, and they literally drew a line around kind of UV, University of Vermont, and the area that it's probably 90% students that live there. So the whole idea, I think, when they created that ward was that students should have a representation because they represent a huge part of our city. So it makes sense for them to have a voice. And, given that whole idea as well, she's very qualified. And then Zariah Hightower, who is 29, just turned 30 on election day. Pretty exciting.
Good birthday present.
What was that?
Good birthday present.
Yeah, exactly. She has a ton of experience. I mean, she graduated from Yale. She has a graduate degree from Yale in the environment and forestry and works for like a international sustainable development organization where they do sustainable development work all over the world. So I think that experience, she's been on the development review board in Burlington. I think that experience is incredibly valuable for the city. So, I would not say that the candidates we've been putting forward are inexperienced at all.
We've got a caller on the line, Fred from Newbury. Good morning.
Morning. Now, what kind of policies would you be in favor of that would help reduce the cost of living in Vermont?
Josh, what kind of policies are you guys thinking about to reduce cost of living?
Well, yeah. So I guess in Burlington, because that's kind of what the show's about, there are a number of issues that we've been putting forward. So, you know, we're going to have a conversation on rent control and different types of it. And our counselors have different ideas around what that looks like. The cost of housing is really out of control in that city, and big landlords have an incredible amount of power to control the everyday lives of their residents. So we're going to look at how we curb that power and how we, you know, give some power back to regular working people. We're going to look at expanding public transit in Burlington and potentially even doing fare free transit. So you don't have to actually pay to get on the bus. That's been a big policy. It's something that cities around the world have done, and it will directly impact in a positive way low-income people and potentially allow more people to not drive. We're going to look at weatherization, and there's an effort to attempt to require landlords to weatherize their homes. That's a huge thing. So, you know, it's just a couple things in Burlington. Every day, everything we do is geared towards it's going to improve the lives of working class people. That's our entire reason for existing. And then I would just say briefly on a state level, there's a bunch of stuff we're working on, from like raising the minimum wage to a living one. I was excited that we just got, the $12.55, but that's nowhere near as far as we need to go in terms of the living wage. There is also, we've talked for a number of years about getting rid of the property tax and exchanging it out for an income-based progressive tax that would be really beneficial, I think, to working people.
Yeah, Josh, could I just circle back real quick? We have 2 minutes left, and I wanted to go back to your response to Fred there, who posed a great question, I thought, about sort of how to reduce the cost of living. And I think one of the big criticisms from the right of progressives and even from the center has been that a lot of the policies that are being proposed, you know, some would call them sort of pie in the sky, too expensive. You talked about expanding public transit. You talked about weatherization. Mm-hmm. These are expensive things to do. How do you accomplish these things without hiking taxes?
So the weatherization issue, we're looking at doing a rule that would require landlords to weatherize up to a certain level of efficiency or pay the cost of utilities, because tenants should not be responsible for the utility costs of housing that is just really not taken care of and not up to any standard by any means. So that would be, you know, that would be a cost on the landlords, and they're making a ton of money in this high rental market, so they can afford to pay. In terms of the fare free transit, there are a number of ideas out there. It's something we're going to be looking at, and we're not going to be, you know, proposing anything that puts like an undue pressure on working people. But you know, it's a conversation that we're exploring is how we pay for that. And it's not something that's going to happen overnight. We're going to have to look at all these different ideas and proposals and kind of figure out a way forward on that.
Great. Well, Josh Ronski, Executive Director of the Vermont Progressive Party, thank you so much for joining us today on the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be on.
Coming up in the next hour, we have researchers from UVM who are going to talk about the state of Vermont's hemp industry. But before that, we've got VT Diggers healthcare reporter Katie Jickling, who's going to give us a brief update on what's going on with the coronavirus here in Vermont.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Colin Mine, sitting in here for Dave Graham on the Dave Graham Show. For the most of this hour, we're going to talk about the state of hemp in Vermont, a market that seems to be showing a whole lot of a whole lot of positive signals, and we're going to look at sort of the landscape for industrial hemp a couple years into sort of its development. But before that, we're going to get a brief update on what's going on with the coronavirus around the U.S. and some updates in Vermont. It doesn't seem there's no confirmed cases here, but on the line with us is Katie Jickling, VT Diggers healthcare reporter. Good morning, Katie.
Hi, Colin.
Hey, so you've been doing some reporting recently on some testing, some cases that have popped up near Vermont. Can you just give a general overview of what we know about the sort of state of coronavirus cases and preparedness here in Vermont?
Yeah, so as of yesterday, the state had tested three people for coronavirus. All three of those individuals tested negative. But we are seeing more and more people being tested. We do know that I think those testing numbers will rise in the coming days. And the number of people monitored are also rising. So the state is currently monitoring 116 people, most of whom have traveled to other countries that have experienced outbreaks of corona, such as China or South Korea or Italy. And then the state has also completed the required 2 weeks of monitoring for 20 people. So according to state officials, it will likely be just a matter of time before our first cases arrive in Vermont.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's always worth sort of mentioning, given the sort of inevitable nature of some of this, some of the sort of precautions that folks can take if they're concerned, or whether or not they are concerned, the steps that they should take to sort of prepare. You want to just talk briefly about what folks can do to sort of, you know, prepare for this inevitability that the coronavirus will indeed get to Vermont, and folks will need to take care.
Right. So hospitals and the state health department are sort of trying, you know, in contact with people and notifying people what they should do. They're generally saying that they should certainly report if you've been in a place or a country where you may have been exposed to the coronavirus. You should also can be in contact with doctors. Especially if you've been in those places or are starting to feel, you know, shortness of breath or coughing or fever. Otherwise, they're saying just be careful and be wise. Like, wash your hands frequently. You don't need to go buy 1,000 face masks. Those generally don't help. Stay home if you're sick. Just sort of general precautions like that.
And as far as testing, what is the sort of process for that? You know, I've heard in places like Washington and stuff, you know, sort of trying to figure out how to use limited testing resources has become a real issue. But if folks do have the flu, do you just ride it out for a while, or how do you sort of figure out whether it's something to really be worried about?
Right now, the state of Vermont has the capacity to test 250 people, which is not a lot, but Vermont recently got a about $5 million grant from the CDC to have more tests. So likely that capability will go up. Right now, if you have the flu, doctors are not testing just regular cough or cold kind of situation. Instead, they're saying, you know, we'll test you if for individuals who have very severe symptoms and have also ruled out the regular flu or common cold, those sort of general respiratory viruses, and they think that coronavirus could then be an option. Doctors are saying that they're right at this point, they're only really testing people where it would really make a difference to find out. But just for curiosity's sake, is not something that they're investing their time and resources in.
And it seems like sort of the closest case that has been confirmed, at least so far, has been a Dartmouth Hitchcock Hospital employee just across the border there in New Hampshire who had traveled abroad to Italy, and there. someone who interacted with him was infected as well. Has that had any sort of repercussions on how they're preparing in Vermont?
That in that case, an individual who, both of these individuals live in Grafton County in New Hampshire, and one of them broke their sort of isolation to attend an event in White River Junction in Vermont last Friday. As a result, the Department of Health has asked anybody who was at that event, which was at the Engine Room, to report that they were at that event and may have come in contact with this individual. And folks at the Engine Room did a thorough cleaning and say that they're going to continue operating events. But I think it more broadly speaking, it just raises the real reality that it's very hard to effectively quarantine and isolate people. And if they want to get out and go to an event, then they probably will, and you can't stop them typically. And so I think that we haven't seen anybody actually impacted or affected by this individual, but I think we will see very similar situations in the coming weeks, potentially.
No, last week's press conference with Governor Phil Scott, he was caught a bit flat-footed with some of the questions that were asked to him about the coronavirus. And my understanding is that the administration has sort of ramped up their planning efforts in the past week, it seems. And today, in fact, in about a half hour here, the governor, his press conference this week is going to focus specifically on the state's preparations for COVID-19. I'm wondering what people outside of sort of the healthcare system and the state government have been doing to prepare, or rather to sort of mitigate the potential impact here?
I think a lot of it has been about communication. So the governor has created a task force, and then you're also seeing businesses and schools take precautions and start to notify people. We've heard at nursing homes there's been communication around what to do, how to monitor, and what will happen. You know, places, for instance, saying, okay, we're going to may consider serving meals for residents in their rooms rather than in a common area. Mm-hmm. I've heard that UVM Medical Center told students to bring their books home for spring break this week in case the classes are canceled and students don't return to campus. And different other colleges have canceled study abroad programs or brought students home from those. So I think people are sort of preparing for the worst and hoping for the best.
Great. Well, Katie, thank you so much for joining us for this brief update on COVID-19, a.k.a. the coronavirus. That's Katie Jickling, VT Digger's healthcare reporter. And you can check out her reporting on this at vtdigger.org.
Thanks, Colin.
And for this last 45 minutes here, we're going to be talking to folks at the University of Vermont about the state of Vermont's industrial hemp industry and work that they've been doing, sort of tracking progress there and the various innovations and developments that have been happening. We're going to have a couple folks on, but right now we are joined by Jane Kolodinsky, who is, well, I'll let you introduce yourself, Jane. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I'm Jane Kolodinsky, and I am a professor and chair in the Department of Community Development and Applied Economics in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences.
Great. Well, we appreciate having you on so much. And maybe first off, you could just give us a general overview of sort of, you know, hemp, the sort of regulatory framework and all that was set up just recently in the last couple of years. And it's really just an emerging industry. So maybe you could talk a bit about sort of the shape that it's taking.
Right. It absolutely is an emerging industry. And I look at things from the consumer demand point of view. So we have the production side where so many farmers got in and kind of found themselves in a pickle at the end of the harvest this year. But I am there to do the research to look at what consumers think, believe, know, and act on this product. Mm. And I'm just so happy to say that we were in the field last week with the Vermonter poll, so hot off the presses, 2020 data.
So what are consumers thinking?
Consumers are thinking that they still support hemp. In 2019, 60% strongly supported the production of industrial hemp. And this year, the strongly support went down a little bit, but the somewhat support went up. So it is clear that about 80% of consumers support the production of industrial hemp in Vermont, and 18% have no opinion, and very, very few oppose it.
Yeah.
So that's what we know about support.
It seems like there's not a lot to oppose, given a lot of the sort of promise that it holds. I know that this past season, some of the reporting that BT Digger did, you know, I think largely because it is such a new industry that among growers and processors that there is, you know, I guess what you could call growing pains, that, you know, there was more hemp than could be produced and that kind of thing. So maybe you could talk about sort of how this last season went and whether or not that shaped at all the views of the industry.
So, as I said, I'm on the consumer side. So when Heather gets on, she can speak mounds about production. We do know that there was overproduction. In fact, there was a quote that said, you know, whenever there's an industry like this or a promise of a new crop, farmers do what they do best, and they produce. Mm-hmm. That's what they do. And so if you have this roadblock in processing and getting things to market, then you run into some problems. And that's exactly what happened. But lucky for hemp, hemp is more than CBD. And that's the kind of surprise data that I have for today, is that people's awareness of the other kinds of products that hemp can be made into has grown tremendously just in this last past year. So, you know, hemp can be turned into 25,000 different products.
Wow. There's, I don't know that we'll have time to get around to all 25,000 today, but I'd love...
I don't have 25,000, but I have three that I can tell you about.
Cool. Look forward to it.
So, while last year about 3/4 of Vermonters had heard of hemp oil, and, you know, hemp, I mean, CBD oil, that was the big craze, right? This year, 96% of people have heard of CBD oil. So that's, these are of Vermonters. So that's basically 100% of people have heard of CBD. Hemp clothing, shoes, or textiles, you know, think of the 70s and maybe the old hippie, but about 75% of people heard about it last year, and this year it's up to 90%. And hemp paper products, only a third heard about it last year, and we're up to about 2/3 of Vermonters. So, and then we have some information about people that we didn't have specifics on what they heard of last year, but about 90% of people have heard of rope. About 2/3 of Vermonters have heard of industrial construction materials. 3/4 of Vermonters know about hemp personal care products. More than half know about hemp food products, and a third know about hemp plastics, which personally I think have such an opportunity in our economy, is to replace some of our single-use plastics with hemp alternatives.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You mentioned Heather recently, and I just want to tell listeners that at 10:30, Heather Darby, who is one of your colleagues at UVM, she's an extension professor and agronomist, is going to join. She's done a lot of research into hemp as well. Returning to some of these sort of, you know, that CBD oil has sort of dominated, I guess, sort of understanding of what hemp can be used for, perhaps in recent years, but that's really changing into things like industrial construction materials and hemp plastics. And I guess I'm wondering, are those things currently being used? Are they being tested? Like, what does the sort of timeline look for actually, you know, using hemp for some of these really innovative and things that we don't usually associate it with?
Absolutely. There are opportunities and things are happening. So I know for a fact that with hemp industrial construction materials, one of the largest companies, and I'm not gonna plug any particular company here on the radio, but that is housed in North Carolina, is booming. Their organization is just booming with agricultural a fabric, such as, you know, hemp takes a lot of black plastic to grow, but there is an alternative to use waste from growing hemp to create the agricultural mats that keep the weeds down. So that company is far ahead of the curve in terms of creating and producing those agricultural landscape fabrics. We have seen so much more in terms of demonstration in construction materials. There are wood products being developed using hemp that are actually stronger than products made out of actual wood, or there can be hybrids with wood material. And think about wood pulp and leftover from the production of other things that we use timber for to make that go farther. And then the whole hemp paper growth situation. Just imagine in the future that your Amazon items might be delivered in a hemp cardboard box. So, there are companies that are out there creating things. Colorado and North Carolina are ahead of the curve in terms of larger scale manufacturing. But that doesn't mean that once we see more demand that, industry in Vermont can join in this hemp revolution.
Yeah, and where is hemp plastics at in terms of development, and what does that kind of look like?
I do know that there is a group at University of Kentucky. We have a proposal in right now to USDA to help fund the development of more hemp plastics. Think about a hemp plastic food clamshell instead of the one-use throwaway food clamshells that we have. There's so many opportunities. I think, though, that our imagination and ideas for innovation are ahead of the curve in terms of where the industry is. So as a researcher, it's my hope that farmers do not give up on this product after perhaps one bad year, that they were also ahead of the curve and industry is catching up with them as well as consumer demand.
I'm sort of an underlying question to all this, which is, why is hemp sort of a preferable material? You know, you talk about sort of combining it with wood or replacing wood for construction. You talk about, creating hemp plastics. I think the benefit to that one's obviously, I mean, plastics don't biodegrade and that sort of thing. But as far as some of these other natural products, why is hemp a preferable alternative?
Well, if you think about it, hemp is a renewable, it's a biomass, and it takes a season to grow instead of 50 years, such as some timber. But when you can combine the quickly growing biomass with longer trees that need a lot longer to grow, you can see that there would be some benefits to those mixing of materials. We know that hemp, and this is more for heather, but that currently it seems that hemp is less chemical intensive than some other crops. Mm-hmm. And for Vermont farmers, it's a way towards that agricultural transition. And I know it sounds cliche, but just as with any other agricultural quote unquote commodity or a good that can become a commodity, don't put all your eggs in one basket. So, to deal with the dairy transition, producing hemp might allow dairy farmers to remain in the dairy business and yet diversify their farm production. So there are lots of benefits. Is it the savior? No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. There is no magic bullet solution to climate problems, to the agricultural transition, to our economic development issues. But it could be one tool in our toolbox to help us be resilient and sustainable.
Cool. And we'll certainly return to some of those issues when Heather joins us in a few minutes here. We're talking to Jane Kolodinsky. She's a professor at UVM who's been looking at consumer opinion towards the hemp industry. If you want to join the conversation, the local number is 244-1777. That's toll free 1-877-291-8255. Jane, you talked about some pretty remarkable statistics that you guys recently found just on sort of how much hemp is becoming sort of part of the public consciousness, not only for CBD oils, which are used for a range of purposes, but various other things, everything from rope to clothes to shoes to even plastics are starting to be developed. What do you attribute the sort of changes in consumer understanding and consumer recognition to be?
Well, I think that we, just as we have an agricultural transition, we have a hemp transition. So, hemp was classified as a narcotic, even though it has less than 0.3% THC. in it, and that association has given it a bad rap, I think. And so over the last couple of years, as hemp has become legalized, it's part of the Farm Bill and so on, that the public is coming around, right? Oh, what is this? And so when you think about how to move from consumer consciousness, as you called it, I like that word, all the way to behavior, which means I'm using these products, and I have some pretty interesting statistics on what people have reported that they're using with regard to hemp products. We often talk about this, first comes awareness, then comes knowledge or attitudes towards the product, then comes an intention, and that all comes before you actually use it. So when you're at this nascent product, even though there's 25,000 different things hemp can be made into, it's still a nascent product in the United States. So it's going to take some time, and that's exactly what we're seeing. So we're seeing that transition from, oh, hemp, what is it? I never heard of it, to, oh, I'm aware of all these things, to, oh, maybe I shouldn't feel so badly about it. It isn't a drug. It's a very useful agricultural commodity, and then the behavior will come after.
Yeah, I've certainly seen some of that. At VT Digger, we've been covering the rise of the industry a lot. And, you know, inevitably you come across the products and people have been testing out the oils and to some positive effects for sure. We've got a couple minutes before we take a break, but can you talk a bit about some of these, some of this data that you have collected on how behavior is changing?
Yes, I would love to. So while more than 3/4 of people last year heard about CBD oil, only about 20% or 1 in 5 in Vermonters reported using it. This year, a third report having used hemp CBD oil. About 6% last year had reported using hemp rope. Maybe they didn't even know they were using hemp rope. And it's 1 in 5 or 20%. Wow. Hemp clothing, it was 1 in 10 last year. Now it's 1 in 4. Personal care products has gone from less than 1 in 10 to 1 in 4. Vermonters said they have reported using a personal care product. And even hemp food products, because hemp seeds and so on are actually quite nutritious. Less than 5% last year reported having tried a hemp food product, and it's 17% this year. So tremendous growth in people reporting they've used these products. Now, perhaps last year they underestimated because they didn't know, and now they're reading labels. So I think that it's probably a few things going on. I didn't know I was using it. Now I know. Wow, what is this product that contains hemp? I'll try it. Hopefully in the future where we get to, oh, I tried it, I liked it, I'll buy it again.
Yeah, those are really, really remarkable gains in just the course of 1 year. We're talking to Jane Kolodinsky here. She's an economist and professor and chair at UVM's Department of Community Development and Applied Economics. And joining us after the break is going to be Heather Darby, who is a UVM Extension professor and agronomist. Stick around for this conversation about the state of hemp in Vermont.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
You're on the home stretch of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. I'm at our studio here in Waterbury, and on the line with me is Jane Kolodinsky. She's the chair of UVM's Department of Community Development and Applied Economics. And joining us now is Heather Darby, who is an extension professor and agronomy specialist. We've been talking about the results from an annual poll that UVM Center of Rural Studies does, looking at opinions of the hemp industry. And we were just hearing about some really remarkable remarkable statistics on the increase or the changes in behavior among folks in Vermont around hemp, you know, sort of becoming aware of or starting to use new hemp products, everything from clothes to food to rope, and sort of CBD oils as well, but a lot of things beyond that. And Heather, I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how the sort of change on the consumer side is impacting the folks who are involved in producing and manufacturing hemp.
Yeah, sure. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. Good morning.
Great. Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I mean, as Jane has mentioned, I'm sure there's quite a buzz around hemp. What most people are kind of seeing in the marketplace right now are these kind of hemp oil products, like the CBD products, kind of making their way into just about everything. And the CBD, you know, explosion has certainly impacted the landscape, the agricultural landscape in Vermont, with farmers, you know, entering the hemp production or entering the hemp industry in sort of full force last year. And, you know, with some not so wonderful outcomes for many farmers, we're kind of waiting to see, you know, how people are going to proceed this season. So, yeah, the farmers definitely tried to respond, but there were some, you know, there were some big bumps along the way.
Can you talk a bit more about what those bumps were and perhaps the sort of how those lessons are being applied to the season to come?
Yeah, well, it definitely, you know, this was nationwide, so certainly not just specific to the Vermont agricultural landscape, but I think, you know, most of the listeners probably realize that hemp, industrial hemp, was kind of officially legalized as a commodity crop in the Farm Bill in 2018. And once that happened, there was a real fever, I think, around all of agriculture to be able to meet these demands in the marketplace. And there was a projected 500,000 acres of hemp registered, essentially, to be grown in the U.S. I mean, that's just phenomenal. Essentially, just a few months after being legalized, everybody was sort of jumping in with both feet. And Vermont was no different, I think. I'm not for certain what the final numbers were, but I believe we were around 9,000 projected acres to go in the ground in the state of Vermont, which is huge.
Yeah.
And far less actually went in the ground, both in Vermont and across the country, mostly because of weather. You know, the weather was very, very difficult last spring and early summer. And I think, you know, many people's plans were crushed, you know, at that point, really early in the season. And then for those that did get their hemp in, much of it struggled because it was, you know, planted late. The quality of the plants maybe weren't so great. Mm-hmm. And then as we sort of got to fall, you know, people started harvesting and realized that it was very time consuming. Yeah. And much of the hemp, you know, a good portion of hemp ended up staying out in the field. And, you know, some people didn't have markets. A lot of people didn't have markets. The markets that did exist, you know, just, I think, also realized they couldn't handle the volume that was coming in. Yeah, so I think there was a lot of heartache and heartbreak and, you know, it last fall. And it kind of is continuing into the winter for sure.
Yeah, I think high hopes and hard lessons was the headline of our story, sort of as these things when hemp harvest rolled around this past year. But can you talk a bit about sort of how the market is correcting for some of this? I know that you spend a lot of time, you know, working with farmers, talking to farmers, sharing best practices, that kind of thing. So what is the sort of, I mean, are farmers sort of giving up on the industry, or is it simply a case of sort of approaching next year with lessons learned?
Both, you know, so many lessons were learned, hard lessons for some. You know, some people were just fine. There are a few established, markets in Vermont, and those folks sort of moved along as normal, and, you know, I'm sure did the farmers that grew for them did just fine. For, the rest of the farming community, there are certainly many farmers that I've talked to that are definitely not growing again this year. Mm-hmm. But as, you know, we saw at our hemp conference at the end of February, there's still a lot of interest. We had about 350 attendees, and it, you know, there was a different vibe for sure. A lot less, energy and more caution.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you know, I think really in some ways we have to think about where we're at. You know, we have a crop that has just been legalized. There's no, you know, there's a building value chain. There's a building industry. You know, these things don't happen overnight. And I think that, you know, we were all so excited that it potentially could,
mm-hmm.
that we decided to take the risk. And now I think people realize that, okay, this isn't going to be as easy as we thought it was. And generally that's farming anyway. And so I think people, you know, those that are really committed are still going to grow, and they're looking, you know, to work with the marketplace to develop markets and products. And it's going to happen slowly. It's not going to happen overnight. And I think people, you know, realize that.
Jane was talking about some really interesting things that are going on with companies outside Vermont, mostly, who are trying to do some innovative things with hemp. And certainly, you know, that if things like, you know, construction materials or, you know, sort of rope and clothes, if these things became, you know, scalable industries that, you know, as those sort of things develop, you'd imagine, you know, that once again, it would become, you know, perhaps there would become a demand for the type of supply that was created last year. And I guess, what kind of work have you guys done to connect, or not what work have you done, but what work are people doing to connect the sort of industries that exist outside Vermont to growers here? And is that perhaps something that will continue to develop?
Yeah, so there's, you know, I think what Jane's referring to is the production of grain and fiber, which is really different than people producing for the flour market. That's mm-hmm. almost, I would say, all the hemp that went into the ground last year, with maybe an exception of a few acres, was for flour production mm-hmm. for the CBD market. And there's far more that can be produced from hemp than just flour. And, you know, so there are so many opportunities here. And again, the value chain, the processing, that's all starting to build. There really isn't much fiber processing in the country, period.
Mm-hmm.
Our country or north of us, you know, it's starting to build. There's businesses coming into various locations. And, you know, the infrastructure's more expensive and the output or the product is less valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's more slowly coming. You know, farmers and those businesses aren't, you know, it's not the same revenue generator that CBD is.
Gotcha.
So it's not going up overnight.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the expectation that people can now, well, I'm not going to produce for flour and CBD, I'm just going to start producing for fiber, there's no place to send that yet. And there's a lot of people in Vermont working on, you know, trying to get businesses built and up and running for fiber, for grain. So it's slow, but it's coming, and it will come. And that's, you know, and connecting with people around us that are doing it. There's a couple of businesses in Pennsylvania, but we learned at the conference that they are not accepting any new contracts this year, and they're taking a break. So I think, you know, there's kind of a lot going on, and things are moving, but not fast enough for all of us that want it yesterday.
Yeah. And Jane, I'm wondering on the consumer side, did you guys ask any questions about sort of do the trends on sort of how industrial production is going and the sort of lessons learned on that side trickle over at all? Or, I mean, how much are consumers paying attention to the sort of trials and tribulations of farmers?
You know, we do have some questions, but these data just came in on Tuesday, and it's Thursday. So, you know, we double down to get you some of the new statistics. But stay tuned. There will be more information to come on the consumer side of the market.
And you know, on the sort of the other cannabis industry, I guess you could call it, and marijuana, there's been a great deal of concern about sort of, you know, that big companies sort of, you know, are going to come to, if the industry is legalized in Vermont, that big companies like they have in other states, Colorado and Massachusetts, are going to come to dominate the market, and that the sort of promise that it shows for small growers and small businesses perhaps isn't going to materialize because the sort of profits are going to be hoarded in a few big companies. And I'm wondering to what extent in the hemp industry, and I think this is probably a question for Heather, but I mean, how do you see the future of that playing out? Is hemp regulation in Vermont built in a way that sort of protects the small growers and manufacturers? Or you mentioned that these sort of big organizations that really know how to do hemp are the ones that have sort of been able to keep moving forward. Are they going to sort of come to dominate?
So, you know, this is a conversation that we had last year, even with all the buzz, and then it was even more prevalent this year. And I think it just goes back to thinking about, you know, who we are in Vermont and the type of agriculture that has the Vermont landscape can support and the consumers in Vermont and around Vermont also support. And yeah, there's a fear, and it's already happening, that hemp will become more of a commodity crop, like, you know, corn and soybeans and other crops that are grown. There'll be big equipment, big acreage, and lots of material available at a very low cost. And that, you know, that's starting to happen out west. There's big fields, large scale fields of hemp that are going in, and now mechanized equipment that's coming through to harvest, especially for CBD production. And, you know, we are already talking about the craft market, you know, and the quality that we can produce in Vermont. So, you know, I think likely, you know, that's the direction our market will go, like it has for most other agricultural crops as well.
So I'd like to actually echo that from a consumer behavior perspective. Vermont can never compete in a large commodity market. That's not only not who we are, we just don't have the landscape to support it. So what Heather just said about the small specialty markets with value added, it's my perception or hypothesis that that's where we will excel in the hemp industry.
Yeah, I know there was some hope to sort of, you know, that Vermont CBD would sort of become distinguished from, you know, sort of large scale or sort of, I don't know, branded, you know, that Vermont could come up with its own brand. Is there any indications of how that's going, whether or not sort of anyone outside Vermont is sort of associating Vermont with particularly good CBD, or whether there's loyalty within the state to that sort of branding?
I do not know. Ahead, Heather, do you know?
Well, you know, so we already have at least one business, if not more, in Vermont that are nationally recognized CBD producers because of the Vermont quality and the commitment they have to their products, and that's Sunsoil, and they're in the Northeast Kingdom, and they're probably the longest operating business, you know, CBD production business in the state, and they've been able to build a you know, national brand, if not, I'm not sure if it's global, and I can't speak for them, but they were at our conference, and I think, you know, they are highly recognized in the CBD world, and they are a competitive force, and that's really exciting. So when a brand, you know, like Sunsoil or Ben & Jerry's, as an example, can set that kind of stage for other Vermont producers, that's really important. So we do already have some of that at collective, like industry association of growers, which would be, you know, something to come here probably in the near future, is likely an important next step in carving out that quality brand. But but that's yet to happen. Again, you know, we're just at the, you know, we're essentially a year into it.
Yeah.
And there's still, I think, I'm not sure if you've mentioned this yet, but the federal rules themselves will go into place in this coming October. And that will be another changing, landscape for growers around the country, meeting and coming into compliance with these new federal rules. So, you know, we're just really early. There's
yeah.
a lot yet to, you know, I guess, unveil.
You're listening to... Sorry, go ahead, Jane.
No, that was Heather.
Oh, Heather?
Nope.
Okay. You're listening to Dave Graham Show here on WDEV in Waterbury. You can call in to join the conversation about what's going on with hemp in Vermont, the state of the industrial hemp industry, the future, and some work that has been going on at UVM to sort of track how consumers and farmers are reacting to some of the changes. The local number is 244-1777, toll-free 1-877-291-8255. I thought folks would be interested to know that CNN is reporting that Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts has suspended her presidential campaign. No word yet on whether she's going to throw her endorsement behind either of the current front runners, Bernie Sanders of Vermont or former Vice President Joe Biden. But I'm sure we'll be hearing about that soon. Heather, you have referenced a couple times a 2020 hemp conference that was recently held in Vermont that brought together various players from around the industry, particularly farmers. You mentioned that one thing is that there's sort of been a drop in excitement, perhaps because of some of the lessons learned in the years past and some of the high hopes going into the season and realization that things aren't going to be quite as easy as they once thought they were. But I'm wondering what else you sort of took away from that conference.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, what's really exciting now is that we're starting to see more scientific research in the area of hemp production. And we haven't had any hemp research in the United States for probably, you know, for a very long time. And now we have universities across the country that are, you know, conducting research on growing this crop, whether it be, you know, economic research or processing or, chemistry and agronomics. But we are able now, you know, and are starting to be able to draw in some, you know, really excellent science to help growers and end users, do the best that we can do. Mm-hmm. We're 50 years behind, 60 years behind on research, really. And we have a lot to catch up on. So that was, to me, really exciting. And to be able to see so much information, good information going out to our farming community. So that was definitely a highlight for sure.
Yeah, and I asked this question to Jane earlier, but what are the sort of benefits of hemp in terms of, like, why is it a crop that we should be wanting to make things out of?
Yeah, so hemp is a crop that just has, it's more than dual purpose, you know, it's like 1,000 purpose. So there's
25,000.
Yeah, right. Oh, there you go. You've Googled it. there's like it's a bast fiber crop. For one, and that's how we know it best historically, really, is the fact that it has these bast fibers that can be, you know, made into ropes and clothing and textiles, and that's really how it gained a foothold, you know, years ago to be able to fabricate ropes and other materials, especially during the war effort. And we also know that hemp now can be made into, you know, plastics and can be used in building homes and can be used as, you know, insulative purposes and vehicles. So it has all these uses just from the stem, basically. And then, you know, you have the seed as well that can be used, in a whole variety of food products. It's very high in protein and it has lots of beneficial fats and, it's a really high protein seed. It's an oil seed. You know, you can extract the oil out of it and use the oil in different cosmetics and nutraceuticals. And I think people remember the stories of Henry Ford, you know, making this car out of hemp and then fueling it with hemp fuel, you know. So all of that.
I hadn't heard that story.
Yeah. Google it.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah, it is pretty wild. So, and then, of course, you have this flower bud, the female flower bud that's unfertilized, that we're just really starting to understand the medicinal properties and health benefits that may have as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just, you know, like a wide open book, which is really exciting for everybody. As far as an agricultural crop, though, on the landscape, which I think actually was your question, is that it's a good rotation crop for sure. And it's a broadleaf crop. So, you know, in our farming systems that are growing grass or corn, it would make a really good rotational crop. It can have a really deep root system that will help with soil compaction and soil structure. It is a nutrient loving crop, so it does require, you know, quite a bit of soil food, but you know, its pests are kind of limited as far as insect pests go, and it can be very, very weed competitive if established properly. So, you know, the amount of inputs in some ways can be less than other crops.
Cool. We've got just a few minutes left here. One story that we had been covering at VT Digger a few months ago was this rather high profile case of a hemp farm in Vermont sent loads of hemp to a dispensary, not a dispensary, but rather a shop in New York City. And this shipment was seized by police in New York City. They sort of posed as if this was a giant drug bust. Of course, this is legal hemp in all these containers. And, you know, I think this really just speaks to the sort of newness of it all. You know, the fact that the sort of this was considered a narcotic and is very difficult by sight to distinguish between marijuana and hemp. But I guess I'm wondering how much is the sort of legal concerns or legal stigma, is that still something that's being fought against on the ground here in Vermont, or is that something we've kind of gotten over?
I'll take a stab at that one.
Not over it.
So I want to say, sometimes.
Go ahead, Jen.
So I've been working on consumer issues in hemp for many, many years, and I feel like we have actually made progress, because I'll say 20 years ago when we first tried to reintroduce hemp as an idea in Vermont, we were told that not until hemp leaves can be orange will we allow it to happen. In other words, whether you can distinguish it. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about it in those terms, we've made huge strides.
Yeah.
But in other ways, we're still at the tip of the iceberg, where it's a huge learning curve. And I think that the systems that need to be developed to catch up with hemp production in terms of being able to distinguish it need to catch up, and they will.
And that's like sort of testing abilities, or what sort of systems would that be?
Well, testing, certifying, and I guess that shipment was certified, but it didn't matter. But, you know, all phases and organizations, from consumer to regulatory to producer, et cetera, need to catch up. And as Heather said earlier, this is baby steps. We're just at the tip of the iceberg with this new crop and new industry. So it's a learning curve for everybody.
Great. Well, I want to thank you both, Heather Darby and Jane Kolodinsky, for your time. It's been a fascinating conversation here about hemp.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks. And I want to thank WDEV for letting me sit in the host chair here for the past couple hours. If you want to learn more about any of the stuff we've talked about, it's all being covered on btdigger.org, Vermont's premier news online news website. Have a great day, Vermont.